This is an interview for Book Life Research, and it's a non-directed interview of Mrs. Edna Countryman of Pleasant Brook, New York. The date of the interview was October 17, 1974, and the interview was taken by John W. Carnahan.
Okay. I was 4 years old when my people, Judson and Viola Thompson, moved on a farm near South Valley. We lived there until my father passed away. And then with my mother and brother, we moved to Pleasant Brook. And that must have been around in the probably 1999, something like that. And in 1911, I married a William Countryman. We lived on a farm near Pleasant Brook until 1921. And in 1921, we decided we wanted to do something different. So we moved to Pleasant Brook. Lived in what was known as the Bush House for a year, and we bought a place here in Pleasant Brook. And we lived there until 1926. In 1926, we bought the property of Seaburn and Edith Jones, a store and a dwelling. And in 1931, my health failed me, and I had to have an operation. So we sold the store to Fred Harris, just the building and a portion of the land. We kept our home here. And at that time, we just had the home. And I did foster mother. So we had one daughter. And after she married, I took in foster children, and I took care of six girls until they grew up and married or went away to school. After that, in 1928, my husband was appointed town clerk due to the resignation of Harold Simmons. 1931 was election year, and I won out in caucus, beat my husband in caucus. And from that time, from 1928, I had been town clerk of the town of Roseboom.
As a town clerk, and you town clerk of Roseboom and Pleasant Brook and
the whole surrounding town, the town.
What were you?
Yes.
Did your husband farm when you lived outside of town? Or?
That's right. We were on a farm.
What did he do when you first moved into town?
Well, he worked on the highway for the highway and road, and then he drove school bus for several years until it come in when they began to get the big buses. And he did some farming while here, rented little places, you know, and did some farming after he sold the store.
Can you tell me some more about the when you were the foster mother of all these girls and growing up here and Roseboom, what it was like for you and for them?
Well, it was very interesting work to work with them. Most of the girls, it wasn't from homes, broken homes. It was from the homes that their mothers had died, and their fathers wanted them to be cared for rather than to live at the home without and be working and to be out on the street without care. So I really had a nice group of girls. And yet to this day, they come back and they all call me mom, and we loved them all. With the girls, I just had one boy, but he didn't stay too long because they thought it wasn't too good for him to be with many girls.
Get that off. Turn it off.
The schools, of course, were little country schools, and for a time I went to what was called Butler's Corners to school, which was in the winter was quite difficult. Sometimes my father used to take me with horses, of course, and the roads would be blocked, and we'd have to go. Maybe we'd leave about 8 o'clock for school and get into school about 10, because we'd have to go around through the fields and all over.
How far away is that?
Oh, about 3 miles. And then we used to, and sometimes when the soul couldn't walk, I was determined I was going to school, and I'd go afoot. I'd go for a while. My brother and I went. Well, then, of course, he got out of school, and I had to make the way alone. Then the school changed, and then we went South Valley to school, and that was where I ended up under my eighth grade in South Valley. I never went here in Pleasant Brook School. And here, that was my life prior as the small schools were concerned.
Can you remember anything about your family life, your mother and father and that sort of thing when you were growing up?
Well, yes, we were a family that lived on means that you earned. It was hard work, you know. And my father passed away when I was 16, which left my mother and brother, older brother, and I alone. He continued to use the farm for a while, but like sometimes boys are, they don't like farming, so he quit farming and we gave up the farm and moved here at Pleasant Grove. Went to church and Sunday school in South Valley, and a girl friend that lived, well, probably about 2 miles from where I would go and meet her, and we would go to the Christian church in South Valley for the morning service. Then in the afternoon they had the Methodist Episcopal had service, so the Sunday school teacher there would ask us to maybe to stay or to come back and go to their Sunday school and church. So she and I would either stay to her father would insist on staying there with her for our lunch, and then going back to South Valley to church and Sunday school again. And sometimes I would come home and go back. But that was very interesting because we loved the teachers and we had nice times. My father and mother were Methodist Episcopal people. Then after I was young, we moved down here, then I went here to the Methodist Protestant church here. And taught Sunday school class. Still do.
Can you tell me some more about your life on the farm before you put any down?
You mean childhood life?
Sure.
Yeah. Well, it was a small farm. We had a few cows. I didn't do too much of the work in far as the work was concerned. They raised hops. Pick the hops, and I would help tie the hops, which was wouldn't be familiar with the ones of today, but we would have to go. They'd set the poles in the yard and the hop yard, and then we would go out with a burlap bag cut in squares and pull the threads out of this, wind the hops around a certain way around the pole, and tie a string on to get the hops starting up the pole.
Well, this is when they were first starting to grow.
That was it, in the spring. And all those different operations that we had to do with the hops, trim them out so there's just so many vines going up a pole. And that was about all there was to be done, but as far as I was concerned, in the hop yard until they got developed and ready for picking.
How many of the poles did that have? I mean, was it a pretty big area?
Oh, it would be probably two or three acres of the land that the poles were in the yards, you know.
Is that pretty common around here?
Quite common. Mm-hmm.
And where did the hop pickers come from?
The neighbors. The
All
neighbors
right,
came in, and then you paid them so much a box. They'd had the hop boxes they would be four, but the two in one section and two in another, with a pole going across from box to box for to lay the hop poles on so that they could pick the hops off the poles. And then they all had a tender that brought that would bring the hops to the pickers. And you'd fill this box, and I've forgotten just what the average, biggest of the box would be. I should say probably around. Of course, there was a certain size they were, but I can't tell. But we would have picked those, and then we were paid by the box. And the box tender, the pole tender, would come with a bag, and we'd bag these hops into these bags, and then they were taken to the till, where they were spread out onto a till and dried.
You said the neighbors came in to help you with the hops and everything.
That's right.
Did you go pick hops somewhere else then? Or?
Oh, yes, we'd go. That would be all fall. We'd go from one place to another.
All in the same valley? Or?
Not always, no. I had been down, went down in Angleville, and maybe a couple weeks, pick hops there. And different areas, you know.
Can you tell us more about hop picking? I don't know anything at all about it.
You don't think of all about it? Well, of course, as I say, when the hopsmen matured, that was in the fall of the year. I forgot. I think we generally begin to pick around the latter part of August and September. And they grew on this pole in clusters at the top of the pole. And the hops sometimes would be in a cluster so you could pick them off. And some were dirty pickers. But you were supposed to pick them, pick too many stems
and
fill the box, you know, the cast. They were supposed to strip these strips off. And there would be, of course, four pickers to each. What would we call it? Station would we call it? Four, and then they'd be, probably they would be in the yard, would be maybe 8 or 10 of these boxes of the four, you know, for each picker. And they'd have a pole tender for each place. Sometimes, of course, wasn't always easy picking. We'd come into snarls and have to work our way through the hops. And then after these was taken to this kill, and this kill was built. Of course, they had what they called the hop houses then. And this kill was lettuce were all over the covering the hill, strong enough for you, of course, for the walk on. And this was covered with a like a cheesecloth. And down in under was this big furnace that was run by wood. And on this furnace, in the top of this furnace, was a pot that you put in fire. Sulfur, and it was yellow powder, and you put that in there, and the heat, of course, and that would go up and would cure the hops. Then they always had a man that would go in to this kill, and with a big ladle like, and just turn and turn these hops until they dried. It was a 24-hour work, because they would dry all day and all night. Then they were put up into bags, and later in the fall, when the hop picking was all done, they would bring in what was called a press, and they'd press these hops into bales, and then there they would sell them to whoever was the agent for buying the hops.
Do you remember doing much on the farm? I mean, not the hop picking grass, but household type things that you might have helped your mother with?
Well, one thing might be of interest to the younger people that we churned. We had butter, meat butter. And we had what was called was like a thresh machine horsepower, but was a dog power machine, which you'd tread, you know. Sometimes we had a dog would do it, sometimes we didn't. So sometimes our children would have to get onto this, tread the machine to churn the butter. This would come out in from this machine. It would make this ladle go up and down in with a big churn, and it would churn till it formed the butter. That was one thing was us that we had.
How long did it take?
Oh, not too long, perhaps half an hour maybe. It would depend. Well, in a way, it would depend on the amount of cream you had in your tub. And this might be of interest, too, to know how they did. That they had in the cellar, of course, the cellars were very clean and sanitary, and they would have racks, and they would have big pans. Oh, the pans probably was 24 by 40 or something like that. And they would sit on these forms, and then when they bring the milk in from the barn, they were strained into this pans, and this pan would, they would sit there until the milk curdled, until the milk was sour. And then they would have this big ladle, skim the cream off, put it into jars or pots, whatever they did. And then when it was to a certain stage, they didn't let it get too sour, but it had to sour a little. And then it was brought up and churned. That was the way that they did the, you know.
How often did you do this? Were you selling the butter, or were you making
it your own? No, they sold the butter. The butter they would pack into, well, sometimes they had tin pails, and sometimes there were 5-pound pails, 5 cans. And then if a farmer, sometimes they would buy, oh, maybe their winter supply, and they were put into tubs and sold 25 pounds or 50 pound tubs, the butter was. And that went, was sold to different
people.
So
you were making butter pretty often?
Oh, yes, they'd have to make, they would have to churn probably twice a week at least, because you had, couldn't let the cream get bitter, you know, or sour. Just the regular household duties.
Were there any seasonal things you had to do besides the hop picking?
not until later years. Then they came into, after the hops went out, then the peas vine came in. And then we would have neighbors who come in the same as the as it did with the hops. Only we picked peas into 12 quart, I think they were pails or buckets. And they were paid so much a bucket. And we would, this was of course after I was, wasn't my childhood, this was after I was growing up, of course. We'd pick these peas and had bags we'd put, so many, 21 pounds I think was in each bag. And this was work. We would take those peas and lay them out on the ground, and on the floor rather, of the cellar overnight. And about 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock, my husband would get up, and we'd bring those peas in the first place before, I guess. We'd have to write tags to what company they were going to in New York. And probably this would be 10, 12 o'clock maybe, before we'd, at night before we get those done and ready to tag. Then in the mornings, I'd say around 5 o'clock, we would carry those up out the cellar and load them, and of course in those times it was horses. We'd load them on this wagon and he'd go to Cheer Valley to the, and send them out by freight or express, whichever way they went, to New York City. And sometimes you'd get good big prices for them. Other times maybe you'd get 10 cent Stanton bags, it depend on the market. So it was loser gain. But they was a paying proposition.
Were there anything that you or your mother had to do during, say, when the men were making hay or something, the cutting hay?
No, I don't remember the, in my childhood days of doing too much in the hay field. Christmas, of course, was always a big event. That is, not to the extent it is today. We would always know that we were going to have a tree and our Christmas dinner, but our gifts were limited. We didn't have, like, we got one gift, and that was it. We'd get in our candy. We'd always hang our stockings, which was filled with homemade, maybe popcorn balls or anything. And then, too, for the decoration, we strung popcorn in strings. And oftentimes would make rings of paper, colored paper and things, for trimming of the trees, which we didn't go into the expense of trimming.
Did they have candles on them or lights?
Yes, we used to have candles, and of course, and then not too many. We were always kind of afraid of fire, so we never had too many candles at home.
Were the gifts that you got usually things that were bought or made?
Made, mostly. Like maybe aprons or something, you know, was practical. I remember in one particular was the teacups and saucers, fancy one. In fact, that little one up there with the gold on was one that I got on the Christmas tree.
Your gifts were hung on the tree then?
They were hung on the tree, mm-hmm.
Do you remember any sort of celebration, say, for the 4th of July?
Well, no. Not so much really in my real young days, but as a young lady, I can remember they used to have celebrations here in Pleasant Brook. Used to have white parades with the had a band here. Of course, the band consisted of South Valley and ones. And they used to have them decorate their wagons and have a real nice parade. But that was on 4th of July. Of course, it was engine. And then in the afternoon, they'd always have a ball game with the local team, you know. Maybe South Valley against Pleasant Brook or Roseboom against them or something.
What have you noticed is the biggest change, say, since you were a child? You've seen a lot of changes.
Oh, well, yes, I have. One thing I think is extravagance. I think they have, in my younger days, we were learned to save and to do things economical, which now I think the younger generation has forgotten. And we used to have more local activities, like parties maybe to people's homes. I've known when I was a girl that maybe the neighbors, maybe 25 or 30 of the neighbors would all come in for a little evening. My mother would always have, things. Then, of course, they didn't have refrigerators, but had places for them. She would always have beans, and it seemed so she could always get something to eat. No matter how big the crowd was, she always found something to eat. So they made their own bread, and they did play games, and sometimes my father-in-law, he played the fiddle, and she played chords on the piano, and the crowd would dance, and maybe you'd go to work and take up the carpet off in the living room and clean empty the floor when you knew they were coming. And this in particular, of course, this was after I was married, might be of interest. We lived on this farm, and it had a very large room. So Father Countryman was having a birthday, so we thought we'd just have a birthday party for him. So we got somewhere or other, my husband took him away for the day, and I hitched up the horses and the team and went around to my father-in-law's and grandfather's and picked up chairs and things. We took the carpet off from the floor, and in those days, our carpets were padded and under with straw. Oat straw and of course that had to be all cleaned up, and we emptied the room ready, and as I say, hitched up the horses and got these things. In the evening, this crowd gathered, after they got there, I called on, and of course, mother was all ready for them to come, because she knew what was going to happen. So I called up and I said, is Dad there? And I said, could he come off? The pigs have got out and I can't get them in. And so she said, yo, we'd be right up. She said, I'll come up with him. So they came up, and when he got there, of course, here was this crowd with the wagons around, and the horses were tied in the barns. He said, must be they're having a surprise party on the well. And so as soon as he opened the door, they began to holler, happy birthday, George. Of course, as I say, they played the violin and the piano and had music there for the dance, and the crowd danced. And along about 12 o'clock, they heard commotion outdoors, and they went out, and the pigs did get out. so they had to chase pigs, just the same. That was the way it was. We lived here, and we were sort of invited to South Valley. We were invited by an East Hill. seemed so that two or three nights of the week, out of the week, we were going to these house parties.
Happened that often?
Oh, through the winter.
Mm-hmm. Was it often hard to get there and back in the winter?
No, because we'd have the horses and hitch on a sleigh, all load in. Maybe sometimes we'd have 15 or 16 onto this big long sleigh, all go together. They generally gather from my house or from my husband from my house and go from there. Sometimes they'd come back and we'd all have breakfast there before they went home. And there were nice clean parties. There was no drinking parties. They were all nice clean parties.
Can you tell me some more about the refreshments they had this time?
Well, Jenny had sandwiches and cookies, tea and coffee. Just light refreshments.
Were they, you said that they happened a couple nights a week during the winter and everything. Did they also have on special occasions or was it just anytime?
Anytime, anytime. Mm-hmm. Anytime, you know, they happen to want to have a party. Sometimes it'd be surprise. It'd be a surprise party on certain homes. And you'd all go in, they wouldn't even know you were coming.
Can you think of any other really big changes that seem kind of make a big difference?
Well, things did, of course, change in the younger days. They wasn't. They didn't have large dairies, like, you know, and as I grew up, we got more dairies, larger dairies, and of course the butter situation went out and they took their milk to either cheese factory or to the creamery, and that was one improvement, of course, from the younger days, because it brought in more work. I think that in my younger days that we go back to the church. People interested. They have too many activities, I guess. Sometimes you hate to think so, but I think the automobiles have had a lot to do with the church attendance. They have taken them away to other activities and things.
It must have made a difference, though, in other ways, that automobiles was supposed to wagon.
Oh, yes. Yes, it did. Today you'll talk with some of the younger ones and grandchildren or something like that, and about what you did, you know, they'll get asking you questions and they'll say, I wish I'd lived back there and I think you had more fun than we do.
Did you?
I believe it. I believe we did.
Even though it was harder?
Even though it was harder. And you didn't mind it in those times, you know what I mean is. You didn't know any better, you know. You lived as the rest lived, and you didn't have that desire to spend. I know we used to, when my daughter was young, and she used to have, it was quite a few young people here then, and they used to come in here to home and maybe put on the radio and play, you know, music, you know, and dance and have a good time here in the home. Well, there was one lady, she thought that dancing wasn't right. She said to me one day, do you think it's right for you to have the girls dancing like that? I said, yes, I do. I said, I'd rather have them here at the home than down on the street corner with nothing to do.
Can you tell me some more about it?
Okay. Well, what in particular do you want?
Well, anything that you might recall or things that have changed around this?
Well, of course, one thing is the post office that was taken out, and the rural road came in.
And what
was that? I don't think I had was around the 1920s when the rural road came. I haven't got it just exactly those dates. As I said, I was very poor on finding dates. What do you mean, here in Pleasant Brook? That was 1921. Well, 1926 when he moved here. Here where we live now. But we moved down to Pleasant Brook from the farm in 1921. But we have lived here in this.
Was it always about the same size, or was it more buildings?
Or? Well, there's more activity here, what I mean is now. For instance, was the stores. Yeah, they were several little stores, you know, all down through here, and man named Piso, he was shoemaker, and another man named Dexter Bond, he had a variety store, which of course I can't remember. This is long before I could remember. This was around in the early 80s, you know. And then they had, of course, feed stores. That was, and there was a blacksmith shop here at that time, and a cheese factory.
The blacksmith shop there when
you moved there? Oh, yes, yeah. The blacksmith shop was still here. Not when that was when I was a girl. The blacksmith shop was here, and that was located just over here, seven miles over. And the last man that I can remember, that I can recall, was Menzel Higgins that owned the place and did blacksmithing there. And then in 1922, the lady that was here with me, her husband bought the residence down here where the garage and store is now, and he ran a blacksmith shop and a garage there until 1960 when he passed away. And then that was about the end of the horseshoeing, and of course the horseshoeing went out quite a while before that. He didn't have too much to look first few years he was there. Then there was a sawmill that was located just a little out of the village, although I can remember him moving a sawmill down over here, just the end of the village here. He would move his sawmill from one place to another, wherever it was timber to be cut down, he would move the sawmill. And in the timber, and that was run by Webster. George Webster was the father, and then afterwards Charlie Webster took over and ran the sawmill. Which now, of course, is there's hardly any industry here, except the son-in-law still has the store and the ground. But all those things have gone out.
No,
that's all trucked in from Shirley Alley.
Was there a school in Pleasant Brook, or did George have to go there?
No, the school was here where the little building of the church It was the old school, the schoolhouse. I can remember, of course, they're going to school here still. And then they built a new school building the end of the village on the Middlefield Road, and which they went there until the school was transferred to Chur Valley. I don't know just what. I can't just tell you what the date of lost track or what date it was that this school, and then this school building was sold. This Mrs. Webster bought the school building of the school, which she had to do, you know, in order to do it right. And then after she became the owner of it, then she sold it to the Methodist Church for a dining hall, which was used for that purpose.
So it was just one church?
No, there were two churches. There was the Episcopal Church, and that was over where the new school building. She just the neighbor her, and she's selling cards of this. She's seen that as many. The Episcopal Church, Methodist Episcopal. And that burned down. I had that wrote down here. That burned down. That I didn't have a year when it burned down. But at that time, there were just building this church in 1847. This church was built, and then at that time, the members of the Methodist Episcopal Church went to burn down. They didn't rebuild. They took their letter to Rosebloom, some of them that wished to, and others stayed here. And in the early, as I said, 1847, this church was built, and then it was called the Union Church, Union Methodist Church, and after that, it was changed over to the Methodist Protestant Church. And in 1877, Parsonage, which was on the same grounds, was built by the request of Reverend Baker and his wife, and that was used as a parsonage. But while we had the Methodist Protestants, and when the Methodist Protestants changed over to the United Methodist, then we joined in with Rosebloom and Middlefield, and still do. And South Valley went by themselves as a Christian church. The Methodists gave up and went into all one denomination Christian. And they requested that the parsonage go into Middlefield. So our parsonage was sold to him once. Some question more about it.
Well, I was just trying to think of it.
This might be of interest too for the younger ones to know that what they did with their horses when they come to church. It was a shed, a long shed was built from the church out nearly to the church. And this had what we call stalls. It was off and had doors on. And when they come, farmers come to church, their horses was taken into these stalls out of the storm while they were in church. And some of the stalls were owned individually. They'd build them themselves and with their own timber and material. And then, of course, that was their stall. They'd always know that they had that when they come to church.
But there were some for anyone else to use?
Oh, yes. There was several places for anyone that came in.
How many stalls were there?
Probably six or eight.
I'm just curious about how many people came to church.
More than they do today. They came, the farmers, you know, they had time to come, even though they had to come with horses in those days.
Did you usually stay on a Sunday? Was there a lot of work that went on the farm, or did you take, say, a day for the church?
Oh, not much activity, only just the main things, like milking and feeding, That was all. There wasn't much. They didn't. The farmers of, in that day, I believe that was a day of rest, but they didn't do too much activity on the farm.
Was it true of both your husband, yourself, and your own farm, and your father and mother? Or?
No, we lived by our, we had one farm and they...
No, I mean that they both treat Sunday the same way, you and your
Oh, family. Yes, yes, mm-hmm.
Where did you say your parents came from?
Decatur.
In New York? New
York? Oh, yeah. My family, my father was come from Cher Valley. His people located up in Cher Valley on the hills. And in the records of the Indians, there's no record of any, and I've always laughed. I said, they must live so far back in the woods, the Indians didn't find them. Oh,
as
yes.
As far back as you know?
As far back as I know, mm-hmm. The my father's, or my, you know, my father's people, originally came from Connecticut. There were three brothers, and two brothers located here in the Cher Valley, and the other one stayed, I guess, in Connecticut. I don't know.
Do you know when that was, or if they came from Connecticut?
No. I wouldn't know.
How old was your father? He was one of the brothers, I guess.
No, it was his father. His father or his grandfather, I don't know. No, it would be his father that came from Connecticut.
Well, okay, thank you. Unless you can think of something else.
I'm not.
Can you tell me something about how your mother made her bread nuts, or homemade bread nuts, sort of thing? Did she have a recipe that you have, or how did she go about doing it?
Well, in those older days, they didn't, in far as making the bread, they didn't have any measurements. They just made this bread. They had, they would make a yeast. They would start what they call a yeast. I don't know just how the yeast was started back in the older, real old days, but when large cakes of yeast came out, then they would start it, and they would have this what they call the starter, and that was made into a jar, and with the sugar and the yeast, and and when they wanted to make bread, they would go into this jar and bring out, we'll say, maybe a cup of this prepared yeast, and mix it up into loaves, into tins, into kettles, you know, or large containers. And that yeast was slow rising. This bread had to be mixed the night before and set into a warm place to raise all night long. And then in the morning, they would make it up, knead it down, and let it raise again. And then after it did that, probably raised twice its size, and of course was used with shortening, sugar, and those things was put into it, and salt, seasoned well. And that was made into loaves and put into regular tins. Sometimes maybe it would be into a big tin, three loaves in a tin, and that would was put to raise again. And then that would be, when it had raised double its size, then you would bake it probably an hour, a little over, into a regular oven, of course, that by wood. And when it was done, you would, if you had three loaves, why, you just pull them apart like this and individually loaves, you know.
Did you tell me about tell me the about the something about pie crust and that sort of thing. How your mother made it?
Well, my mother used to take large. She'd have what they would call the milk pans. They were big pans, probably. They were probably 14 inches across, big pans they were. And she'd always have this pan of flour ready to bake, sifted ready. And she'd make a little hole in the middle of the flour, and she would take, and of course, in those days, I always used lard, never thought of anything else but lard, and would put her lard in the middle, and so much, she wouldn't measure it, she'd just dip it out and put it in, and she'd put a little water in, and she'd begin to stir and her flour in from her big pan, and until she had it where she could handle it with her hands, and then she would mold it down and make it into pies. And I never knew her to fail. Yeah. She made delicious pies.
Can you remember any other specific, you know, recipes or anything that your mother,
Well, one thing I can remember we used to specialize on, we loved so much, was pearl tapioca. She used to make it, we used to have these probably 10, 12 quart buckets. And of course then I had brothers at home, and she would, I could put the milk into this big bucket, into a double boiler, set it into something else, and pull that milk out hot, and she would mix this cocoa, this tapioca and sugar, and no measurements, of course, again, and season it, and let it boil till the tapioca was clear. It would be white when she put it in, and then when it was done and cooked enough, it would be clear. And there was eggs, of course, used with it, and that was our dessert. Also, you might say, strawberry shortcake in those days was made into big dripping pans, and then they would put one layer in, and then would grease the top. That was also made, not with recipes, but so much shortening and so much this, you know, and soda. Mostly soda and cream of tartar was used in those days. And they would be at one layer. Then they would spread that over with a little butter and put another layer on top and bake it. When you're ready for your strawberry shortcake, you'd lift this top layer off and put your strawberries on that, then put that back on, put another layer of strawberries on. Oftentimes, I can remember us children never wanted anything else. We didn't want anything. On just the strawberry shortcake. Of course, they'd be made in these big dripping pans, and that would be our lunch.
Do you remember, like, picking berries and that sort of thing? Did you keep them, or did you eat them right away, or dry them, or...
Oh, no.
Them,
we did both. Was never so much in cans in those days, but we did in heavy sugar, you know, and put down in jars. And also, they used to dry them. I can remember my mother having a rack over the kitchen stove and with cheesecloth on. And we'd peel apples. We had what we call an apple peeler. And we'd run that apple peeler, and somebody else would cut them off and quarter them, and lay these apples all upon this, and put another cloth over the top to keep the flies off, and dry the apples. And we used to dry plums, and I don't know of any other fruit she ever dried, only the apples and the berries and the plums. And then in the winter, when you got ready for a pie, you'd have to take them, put them to soak for season.
You dry the berries the same way?
Yeah, mm-hmm.
Something else
they don't do anymore. No, no.